Welcome to Guide to the Cosmos on WebTalkRadio.net with your host, Dr. Robert Piccioni, physicist, public speaker, and author of Everyone's Guide to Atoms, Einstein, and the Universe, and his new second book, Can Life Be Merely an Accident? With Robert as our guide to the cosmos, we will explore the frontiers of science and participate in the exciting discoveries of physics, astronomy, and cosmology. Now, providing public access to science, here's your host, Dr. Robert Piccioni.
Thank you for joining us, and welcome back. Today we will launch a new series on Guide to the Cosmos about the lives, challenges, and accomplishments of famous scientists. I'll lead off this series with the first famous woman astronomer, Henrietta Leavitt. Leavitt wasn't even allowed to be an astronomer because of her gender, but she nonetheless earned an eternal place in the history of science by solving the greatest problem in astronomy and opening our eyes to the heavens as never before. As usual, we have some great images posted on my website, so go to guidetothecosmos.com, click on the microphone icon, and from the menu of radio shows, pull up today's show, Henrietta Leavitt, First Famous Woman Astronomer. Henrietta was born on the 4th of July in 1868, just a few years after the end of the Civil War. She was born in Lancaster, Massachusetts. She was the daughter of a Congregational minister and a descendant of one of the very first settlers in the United States, a Puritan deacon by the name of John Leavitt, who came from England to Massachusetts in approximately the year 1634. And he founded the oldest church that has been in continuous usage in America. Henrietta Leavitt was educated at a college that was then called the Society for the Collegiate Instruction of Women, if you could believe that. Thank goodness they later changed the name to Radcliffe College, and that now has been incorporated as part of Harvard University. Leavitt graduated with a bachelor's degree in 1892 at the age of 24. She didn't immediately have an interest in astronomy and took her first astronomy course in her senior year, but she did get an A-, so that was an encouraging sign. Unfortunately, she became very ill after graduating and progressively lost her hearing. Henrietta Leavitt was hired by the Harvard Observatory, and her job description was computer. She was paid the fabulous salary of $10.50. A week, that is. I hope she didn't spend it all in one place. She was hired by the astronomer Edward Pickering to examine, measure, and catalog the brightness of stars that were captured on photographic plates. Actually, he hired a whole team of women computers, and these ladies were referred to as Pickering's harem. Now, measuring light intensity of objects that are captured on photographic plates is a very important task in astronomy, and it continues to be even through today. That activity is called photometry. Image number one on the website shows a picture of Henrietta Leavitt at her desk at the Harvard Observatory. And as you will see, she was a straight-laced, proper New England lady. Now, in those days, women were told that they were not allowed to operate telescopes or even become astronomers. But since Leavitt was deaf, maybe she didn't hear all that. In any case, she started studying the changing brightness of what we call variable stars in the Magellanic Clouds. Now, there are two Magellanic Clouds, the large and the small Magellanic Clouds, and they're both in the southern hemisphere and were first discovered by Europeans during the circumnavigation of the globe by Magellan. Variable stars are a particular type of star whose brightness changes in a regular periodic manner. And we now know that some of these variables pulsate. And what that means is that they get larger in size and then they shrink down again and they enlarge and they shrink in a regular fashion in periods of between several days to several months. And when the stars are at their largest size, of course they have the greatest surface area, and this leads directly to them being much brighter than when they shrink to their smallest size. There are several different types of variable stars, but the Cyphids are the most important class of all. These are very massive, young stars that are unstable. Again, they grow in size and then shrink down again and repeat that process over and over with the same period between cycles. Cyphids can be between 5 and 20 times more massive than our Sun and can produce as much as 30,000 times the light intensity that our Sun does. Indeed, if our Sun was a Cyphid, the Earth would have been fried long ago. Cyphids are so bright that the Hubble Space Telescope has been able to identify Cyphid stars as far as 100 million light years away. That would be about 1,000 times the size of our own galaxy and nearly 1% of the way to the edge of our visible universe. Image number 2 on the website shows a variable star in the galaxy known as M100. That is the 100th entry in the Messier catalog. And this image was captured again by the Hubble Space Telescope. The bottom portion of the image shows a large area of the galaxy itself, with the galactic core being slightly off to the left of the image. And above that, there are three smaller frames which show an enlargement of a certain section of the galaxy that has been enclosed in a square. And in each of these three smaller images, inside the yellow circle, you see a star. It's the same star in each image, and the star is dimmest in the left image, it's brightest in the right image, and it has a brightness that's in between in the middle image. So this star cycles from being relatively dim to relatively bright and back and forth and back and forth. Now, Leavitt studied countless images of each one of several thousand stars before she came to a brilliant realization. So to paraphrase Thomas Edison, discovery in science is sometimes 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration. The key is you never give up. Now, during that long and a very exacting process, Henrietta Leavitt saw a critical pattern that no one else had ever noticed before. And that was that the stars with the longer periods, the greater time between cycles, were the brightest. And it's important to note here that often stars look brighter just because they're closer to us. But in Leavitt's case, she knew that all the stars in each of the Magellanic Clouds are at about the same distance from Earth. And we know that because they all seem to be bunched together in the sky. And since they're so close together in the latitude and longitude coordinates of the sky, it seems reasonable that they also should be close together in terms of their distance from Earth. The distance that you can't perceive when you simply look at a picture from the heavens. And therefore, she was quite sure that the longer period stars actually looked brighter because they were emitting more energy, not because they were closer. So they were intrinsically brighter. Realizing all this, she was able to establish a quantitative relationship between each star's period and its maximum intrinsic brightness, which we also call its luminosity. Image number 3 on the website is a graph of this relationship. Here you see that the standard Cepheid stars, which are shown in yellow, are each plotted according to their periods and their maximum brightness. And as Henrietta Leavitt said, it's quite easy to draw a straight line through almost all of those points. Looking at the axis, we see that the luminosity of these stars varies between a few hundred times the brightness of our sun to several tens of thousands of times the brightness of our sun. And the period with which these stars are oscillating between brightness and dimness varies from as little as one day to as much as 50 days. Also shown on this chart are two other types of variable stars, a type 2 Cepheid, which is shown in red, and the RR Lyra stars, variable stars, which are shown in blue. And they also have well-defined relationships, but their relationships are different than those of the type 1 Cepheids. Since the type 1 Cepheids are the brightest and can be seen from the greatest distance, these are the most important variable stars. You are listening to Guide to the Cosmos on WebTalkRadio.net. I am your host, Robert Piccioni, and we are talking today about Henrietta Leavitt, the first famous woman astronomer. We'll be right back after these messages. When you're planning a cruise, the best place for comparing prices and itineraries is CruiseDirect.com. You can choose your cruise by destination, cruise line, or budget. CruiseDirect.com is your online destination for cruising.
Explore Dr. Piccioni's website, GuideToTheCosmos.com, and check out the spectacular discounts that are available to you, our radio audience. Robert's first book, Everyone's Guide to Atoms, Einstein, and the Universe, makes the exciting discoveries of modern physics, astronomy, and cosmology understandable for everyone. And it was just selected as the best science book of the year by National Best Books. As Robert says, you don't have to be a great musician to appreciate great music, and the same is true for science. If you can change money, you can understand Einstein. Robert's second book, Can Life Be Merely an Accident?, describes how precisely tuned the universe is to support life, and shows how amazingly improbable that is. Go to Robert's website and send us your questions, comments, and suggestions for future shows. That's GuideToTheCosmos.com.
We're back talking about Henrietta Leavitt, the first famous woman astronomer. Well, certainly it's very nice that Henrietta was able to discover a great new piece of science, but the bigger question is, what is the importance of this discovery? Actually, it solved one of the thorniest problems in all of astronomy, and that is, how can we figure out how far away everything that we see in the heavens really is? Now, when astronomers look at the sky, it's easy for them to measure the angles in both latitude and longitude. They actually call it declination and right ascension, but those are just technical terms. It's easy for them to measure these two angles and determine where the star is across the plane of the sky. But how do we know the distance to the stars? Well, in ancient times, in fact, people thought that all the stars were at the same distance. They thought that stars were points of light on the inner surface of a giant crystal sphere that completely surrounded the Earth and which rotated about the Earth once every 24 hours. Can you imagine how fast it had to be going? Well, of course, now we know that none of that is true. that it's the Earth that turns once every 24 hours, and so we only have the appearance of the sky rotating above us. And we also know that not all the stars are at the same distances. In fact, some stars are a billion times further away than others. So how is it that Henrietta Leavitt's discovery enabled us to determine the distance to the stars? Well, this is how it works. Several Seyfert variable stars happen to be found in our neighborhood of our galaxy. And using other means that he developed, the Danish astronomer Hertz Sprong was able to measure how far away these Seyferts were. We'll have to talk on another show about how one might be able to do that. For now, let me just say that it's a lot easier to figure out how far something is away when that something is in your own neighborhood than when it is millions of light years away. Now, for the stars that Hertz Sprong measured the distances, we can take those stars and see how bright they appear in our telescopes here on Earth. Since we know how far away they are, it's easy to compute the intrinsic brightness of the star, the amount of energy these stars are emitting each second. And this provides an absolute calibration for Henrietta Leavitt's period-luminosity relationship. Now, once we have that, when we find another Seyfert variable star somewhere else, and we measure its period, we can use Leavitt's relationship to tell us the distance to the star. And this is how that works. In a prior show called Einstein, Light, and the Odd Nobel Prize, we discussed that light rays are really composed of a vast number of separate particles called photons. So picture in your mind a star. Let's say it's our sun. And imagine that that star is surrounded by a spherical surface that has the diameter of the orbit of Mercury. And now imagine a second spherical surface surrounding the sun that has the diameter of the orbit of Venus, and a third with the diameter of Earth's orbit. It turns out that Venus's orbit is about twice the diameter of Mercury's, and Earth's is about three times the diameter of Mercury's. So the ratios of the diameters are simply 1 to 2 to 3. So all the photons coming from the sun will pass through all three of these spherical surfaces you are imagining. They all come from the center, the sun, and they're all traveling outward on straight lines, so they really have no choice but to pass through each of the three spheres. This means that the same number of photons are crossing each of the three spheres surrounding the sun every second. But the larger spheres, of course, have larger areas. The Venus sphere has twice the diameter and thus four times the surface area of the Mercury sphere. And Earth's sphere has three times the diameter and nine times the surface area of Mercury's sphere. With the same number of photons crossing each sphere per second, it makes sense that the larger spheres have fewer photons per square inch per second. So a 4-inch telescope on Venus will only capture 1/4 of the light that it would on Mercury. And that same 4-inch telescope on Earth would capture only 1/9 as much light as on Mercury. All this is called the inverse squared law. The intensity of light drops with the square of the distance. This law is true for light from any distant source, be it stars, supernova, quasars, galaxies, or what we're talking about today, Seyfert variable stars. Thus, since we know, thanks to Leavitt, how much energy a Seyfert is emitting by measuring its period, and we know how much light reaches our telescope on Earth, we can compute that star's distance using the inverse squared law. This is a technique in astronomy which is called using a standard candle. Astronomy is an ancient science, and so it's filled with terms like standard candle. This is something that really we all have some experience with. If you look down a road and there's a series of street lamps, which are all made the same, it's pretty clear that you will see that the street lamps get dimmer and dimmer and dimmer the further they get away from you. And in fact, if you made a measurement, you would discover that their brightness falls off as the square of the distance from the observer. We all see the same thing on the freeway driving home at night, looking at the headlights from the cars on the opposite side of the road. So, for the first time, astronomers were able to accurately measure vast cosmic distances using Henrietta's relationship and identifying Cepheid variable stars in other parts of the universe. Leavitt published her results in 1912, and about a decade later, Edwin Hubble, after whom the space telescope is named, used her relationship to show that our universe is vastly larger than anyone had ever thought. Hubble found Cepheids in the Andromeda and other nebula, as they were then called, and with Leavitt's relationship, Hubble showed that Andromeda was 100 times further away than anyone believed. This meant that Andromeda was really 100 times larger in diameter and was emitting 10,000 times more energy than astronomers had assumed. It wasn't simply another fuzzy little patch of stars in the sky. It was really a grand galaxy in its own right, and bigger, in fact, than our own galaxy, the Milky Way. Andromeda has about 1 trillion stars. Hubble found other galaxies that were even further away, again using Cepheid variable stars and Henrietta Leavitt's rule. So almost overnight, our universe became 1 million times larger based on the essential contribution of Henrietta Leavitt, the first famous woman astronomer who overcame deafness and male chauvinism to solve the greatest problem in astronomy. Leavitt was eventually promoted, and she became the head of the photometry department of the Harvard Observatory, supervising the harem. Sadly, Leavitt died in 1921 of cancer at the age of 53, before the great significance of her work became widely known. She never received, in her lifetime, the recognition that she deserved. Years later, several astronomers, including Edwin Hubble, strongly recommended Leavitt for the Nobel Prize in Physics, but nothing ever came of it. Marie Curie had already won 2 Nobels, so gender probably wasn't the reason. One reason was that at this time, the Nobel Committee didn't think astronomy was in the same class as quote-unquote real physics. And before Leavitt, astronomy wasn't, in fact, really a quantitative science, so there was some argument to be made for that. Astronomy was more about observing and cataloging. Now we know that Leavitt, as much as anyone else, made astronomy quantitative. It also didn't help that her later boss tried to take credit for her contribution, saying it was his insightful interpretation of her data that was the most important. But there was an even stronger reason why she didn't get the Nobel Prize. Alfred Nobel's will, which established the funding and the rules for his prize, specifies that all recipients must be living. The great value of her work wasn't recognized until after her death, and so she wasn't qualified to be a candidate for the Nobel Prize. Leavitt has been honored posthumously with an asteroid and a crater on the moon being named after her. And I believe that the science of cosmology, the study of the universe, was launched primarily by 3 people, Leavitt, Hubble, and Einstein. Henrietta therefore rests in the company of other great scientists, and her place in the history of astronomy is assured. Before we sign off, take a look at image number 4. This shows the Seyfert variable star known as RS Pup. The center of the star is just off to the right in this image. It's so bright that we would not be able to see the surrounding gas around the star if it was included in the image, so that's why it's been cut out. From observations of this star, we know that it has a period of 41.4 days. So every 41.4 days, it reaches its maximum brightness. And at maximum brightness, more energy is being emitted by the star, and you can think of that wave of maximum energy spreading out from the star, moving, of course, at the speed of light. Now, if you look at some of the gas surrounding the star, you will see that certain regions are brightly illuminated, as indicated by 2 yellow arrows. And these are called light echoes. When this maximum brightness of the star reaches that gas, it glows much brighter than the gas around it. So we see the reflection from that gas of this maximum brightness wave moving out from the star. Now there are 2 arrows, and so what we're seeing are 2 waves of maximum brightness. And they're separated, of course, by 41.4 days, the period of the star. So we know what the distance is between those 2 light echoes. It's 41.4 light days. Since light travels over 16 billion miles in one day, 41.4 light days corresponds to about 680 billion miles. And knowing that distance, and by measuring the angle that we see in our telescopes between those 2 light echoes, we can calculate accurately the distance from Earth to RS Pup. And the answer is 6,500 light years, measured to a precision of almost 1%, a really superbly accurate measurement. In astronomy, any time you can measure a distance to better than 10%, it's a real accomplishment. So having a measurement that's almost 1% accurate based on the characteristics of a Seyfert star is truly remarkable. Well, thank you for tuning in today, and remember, you are never too young or too old to wonder why.
Don't forget to explore Robert's website, guidetothecosmos.com, and check out the spectacular discounts on his books that are available to you, our radio audience. Send us your questions, comments, and suggestions for future show topics. That's guidetothecosmos.com. Goodbye.